Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about HCLRS, which hopefully you've all used by now, because the lab was due yesterday. Talked about some components you probably, you may have not started using yet, namely the data memory, which is how we're going to implement rmoveq, rmoveq, push, pop, call, return, which all need to access memory in addition to reading an instruction, and our register file. The built-in register file that stores RAX, RBX, and so on. We mentioned that RHCL has some more choices, for what you do than what the textbook does. So, for example, we discovered that the textbook did this thing where IRMoveQ had this plus zero. We don't have to do that. We had this import for memory results. You're not going to have to do that because we don't have we have more choice in what connections we make than whatever the textbook's picture of the processor was. And we looked at sort of two approaches to building a CPU. And one was taking advantage of our textbook's notion of stages and just looking at the stuff in each stage, figuring out for every instruction what needs to happen, and adding all the components, the muxes you need to make that work. Another approach is you get the whole thing together, and you figure out, given the muxes I have, what do I need to do? Or if I can't figure out how to do something, what connection do I add and add a mux to make that only happen for this instruction? And you just go instruction by instruction, figure out how all the muxes need to be set, and each time you can't find any solution, you add some muxes to make it work. This is sort of generally what I would expect you to do, one of these or some combination of the two, when you're doing your various HCL assignments. Usually we'll have you work instruction by instruction, so we'll probably end up looking more like approach two, but approach one is also a fine way of thinking about it, which might let you have less in your head at a time, therefore be easier. I'd like to briefly walk through our textbook stages, and in particular just primarily to familiarize yourself with the names the textbook uses for things compared to some of the pictures we've seen. So our textbook has its instruction fetch stage, and it calls the parts of the opcode, so the 4-bit what instruction type category is it, like all Q is the same 4 bits, calls that the I code. It calls the second 4 bits, the lower 4 bits, which, for example, determine if we have a conditional jump, what condition is it? If we have an opq, is it an add or a subtract or an XOR? That calls that ifunc, or the function code. RA and RB, as you expect, are the register numbers. And valc is what the textbook calls either the target of a call or a jump, or the displacement in a move. And a subtlety here is that these are in different places in the instruction, and it calls them both valc. It also computes a nut quantity it knows as valp, which is the PC plus the instruction length. And this is the value we'll assign to the PC in the normal case. And then we get to our decode stage. And we learned that in our decode stage, that this was not what we did. We had this extra case where sometimes we needed RSP. So we had these extra instructions, push, pop, call, and return, need to read the stack pointer. Stack pointer isn't RA and RB for any of them. So how did they do that? We added a mux. And the sort of way I would recommend figuring things out, if you want to go the stage-by-stage route, is you just list out the instructions and say, what is the value of this input that's in this stage? And this is what I just did for all the instructions in Y86. Just filled out this table and figured out, oh gosh, I probably want to read RSP, so I'm going to put it somewhere. And I just arbitrarily decided to read it from source B. I could have done source A. And that's how I figured out what to do. Okay. So that gave us our instruction decode. So then we get to execute. And in the execute stage, We have a signal called VALE, which is our ALU output. This is what our textbook names the ALU output, regardless of what it's computing. And we also deal with condition goes. Those are part of the execute stage. We haven't seen condition code logic yet. You're going to have to implement it, eventually. And our textbook has a signal called CND, which is based on the condition codes for iFun, based on the iFunction code. So like for a jump, what condition is it? Or for a conditional move, what condition is it? Based on that, it's are the conditions satisfied? Like, is it the case that we should go on? And so for example, for a conditional move, and apparently I can't draw muxes, we would have this sort of logic, where this signal here is the con signal that the textbook talks about. And we just have all the condition cases based on the condition code bits in the instruction. So questions on what I've covered so far? Yeah? CND, sorry. This looks like, yeah, your question, this looked like an LND, this is a CND. That's the name our textbook uses, even though perhaps they should spell it out as conditions met or something like that. Okay. And so then we have our using our condition codes, and we have our execute stage, and we learned that this wasn't what we wanted to do for the execute stage, just like we had to add something here. And we could figure that out by looking at what the textbook solution was, or we could, again, just work through all the instructions and say, which ones does this work for? Now we could look at all these instructions and say, can we do NOP with this? Answer is yes, we don't care what the ALU is doing for NOP. Can we do add? Yeah, we want to add to register values. This will work for that. Can we do M remove Q? And we're like, no, we want to add a displacement to a register value. We can't do that with this. We need some extra signal there. We need to somehow wire that up, and so on. And so if we did that, we discover, oh, okay, we need to draw, we need inputs from the displacement for M remove Q and I remove Q, and we definitely need constants. And the textbook calls the signals we figure out ALUA and ALUB. Questions on this? Gives us something like this. We also have, for example, our memory stage. We have here, there's one signal the textbook calls VALM. This is the output of the data memory. Because the memory stage does two things. We either write the memory, in which case there's input signals. I'll talk about those in a second. And there's also and there's no irrelevant outputs, or we read the memory, in which case this is the name of the output. The textbook has this convention that you've been seeing here that 64-bit values are named val something. Not a great convention, but that's what they're doing. And that's why they name all these things val m, val e, val p, and so on. That. And again, we need to work through sort of how we wire this up. And again, we will discover that this is the straightforward case, that usually we want to write a register value when we're writing, and usually we're computing the address from the ALU, but that doesn't always work. And again, we need to walk through all the instructions. So what are the instructions where we need something other than this? where we need a mux in one of those circles. Of this list here. Yeah.
Is it the pop that we need mux?
So you're saying pop is one of them. So why do we need an mux for pop in one of these places?
Because
we need to put
the
address together. Yeah. So pop is going to read from RSP, the memory from the address of RSP at an RSP, but it's going to compute RSP mom plus 8. So this signal for pop is going to be RSP plus 8, but we actually want the value in RSP, and I didn't draw that line, to be snuck over here for pop. And that's a little bit busy here. But you want to sneak over and get the value of RSP as the address input for pop. Okay, so that is one case where we in fact need a mux. There's another on this list. So one case is pop, where we're computing RSP plus 8, but that's not where you want to access memory. You want to access memory at RSP. So we need to sort of bypass the ALU. There's another case on this list where we need a mux too. We can't just do the direct connection. So let's see, can anyone eliminate some of the cases? Tell us cases where you definitely don't need a mux. We're sure that it works out if we don't add a mux there, that we can access memory correctly. One of them is really easy. Yeah. NOP. NOP is the really easy one. We're going to deal with NOP by just telling the memory, please don't do anything, through the read bit and write bit signals. Yeah?
Is it calls to get to access the stack to get the return address?
So you're saying call would be the one where we have to do something, we need a mux, and the problem you said is?
That you have to access store the memory address instead.
So you have to use the stack as the problem? So you're saying that we can't set this input correctly? So in call, where are we writing? So call, where does call write memory? So
it writes the memory address to the stack and then calls it, and then the return address pops it off the stack, right?
Return pops it off the stack. Call pushes it on the stack. So how does it, to push on the stack, what's going to go into the address input? So current address, and you have to move it. So we have our stack. It points to the top thing on the stack. Call is going to push just below it. So it goes to writes to memory. It writes at RSP minus 8. So it, in fact, for the address, it doesn't need one. But you're saying, well, what is it writing there? What did you say it was writing?
I think I did say it was writing the
address. Which address? Okay, so the address to return to. So where do we get that from? Is it on this picture? Anyone see it on this picture? The address to return to if we're doing a call. Or do I have to add something to compute it?
Yeah.
So when we have a call instruction, where is the return address point to?
The instruction after.
So it points to here, where this is our PC, points to call. And we want to get a pointer to the next instruction. So how are we going to compute that? Yeah?
Is it all the way down to the bottom left?
Yeah, so we add the instruction length, and that points to the next instruction now. So we advance, we have call. This takes up, turns out, 9 bytes in memory. So we add 9, and we get a pointer to exactly the next instruction, and that's labeled as a valp on this picture. And to implement call, we need to somehow get this valp all the way over here. So we're going to need to add a mux where we have one option being from the register file and one option being to take that valp value and forward it all the way over to the memory. And that's why we need a mux for call. So as for the address we do in fact get from the ALU, but there's good observation that return is going to need to do something with the address input, just like pop does, because it's very like pop as far as how it computes address. But call, like push, it's actually going to compute RSP minus 8, and that's where we want to write memory, so we don't have a conflict with the original no mux version of this picture. Okay. Any questions about these examples here? Okay. So our textbook calls the inputs to the data memory adder for the address input and data for the data input. The address input, most of the time it's the ALU output, but we had those two exceptions, pop and return. And the data input, most of the time, it's valb, that is one of the register file outputs. But we had some tricky cases, call and push, where things might be, we might have to think about it. So we end up with something like this. Here I've just shortcutted the PC plus 9 rather than drawing an ugly line from valp all the way around. So then we have our last stage, which was, besides PC update, sorry, our second to last stage, write back, which is where we write registers. And the straightforward thing is that we write to the M port from memory and to the E port from the ALU. And this is what our textbook does exactly. It just connects the register value inputs like that. You don't have to do that. You could choose to do in some different way. So given these connections, which of these instructions can't we do? So given how I've set things up here in this picture, which instructions do I have to add muxes, like cross out lines already have to do it to make it work? Where have I already like goofed up somehow? Can anyone give me any one example where we can't actually do that instruction correctly with the muxes I have drawn? Yeah?
Push.
Why not push?
Because based off the destinations, we don't have a way to write to the stack pointer.
We don't have a way to write to the stack pointer. So we need some way to write to RSP here for push. How about any others? Any other instructions we can't do? Or is it just push? And the others are fine.
MRMoveQ.
So MRMoveQ. So what's the problem with MRMoveQ?
So I see one way to formulate a value, but you can't ever get the images to
that. Okay, so you don't see it. If it turns out MRMoveQ is one that this picture does not work for. And it's a very similar type of problem to the one we saw with push. Source B is in connection to one of the?
No, register
source B. So register source B, you think should be?
Connected to one of the destination.
Okay. So your problem here is that we're, so you think register source B maybe should be connected to destination E? And why would you want to do that? So what's destination E being going to be used for?
It's not the one to register destination,
Okay, so your problem is one of these. And so what's wrong with these for, what, so for MRMoveQ, what should we do? What should be?
It should be MUX.
It should be MUX, which one? Destem or Desti? So
it's, I think destem.
For destem? Okay. And what should the MUX be selecting for MRMoveQ? So what's the problem you're trying to fix by adding a MUX?
You're getting something from memory, but you're never putting that value into your register.
You're never putting that value into register. So what? So we have a value coming out of the memory. It's going on this wire here, and it's going into the next R-dest-M. So it's going to be stored in whatever register number we pass to dest-M. So for MRMoveQ, which one should that be? Yeah.
Are we supposed to add F to dest-M so that we don't write on that particular register?
So are we supposed to add F so we don't write for which instruction?
For M.
Yeah, okay. So you want to put an F, you want to have a MUX, and you want to have an input of 15 to avoid writing. So which instruct, can you give me one instruction here we shouldn't be writing for M to? You have this list, not push, MRMoveQ, pop call. Which, give me any one of those which you think we would use that 15 input to destem for. Yes? NOP. Yeah. So NOP is the simplest case here. So NOP, previously, with our memory, NOP was kind of free. Like, memory already did what we wanted here. Here, it's not, because we, the way I've wired things up, we need a way to not write to both of these register numbers. Because when we have a NOP, our NOP is encoded as 1, 0, and let's say we have some, you know, you have some other instruction following it. Let's say it's another NOP. So then after the NOP in memory is 1, 0, and guess what? We're gonna interpret what's after the NOP. It's gonna be RA and RB. So we're gonna write to register 1 and register 0 if we don't do something on a NOP. So the NOP case, we need a MUX there already for the NOP case. So we need a MUX for the NOP case. And the same thing is true for MRMoveQ. So for MRMoveQ, destem, like, is what, you know, what we want to write. But we don't want to write to dest D, so we better send 15 for dest D, because we don't want to update the register file with a value from the ALU. That's not something MRMoveQ does. We use the ALU to compute an address. We don't use that address to update a register. So we need the 15 input there. And as observed, for push, we need some way of passing RSP as the register to update for DestD, and this is also the case for pop and for call. Because all of those update the stack pointer and don't have the register number RSP in them anywhere. So we need to send that to the register files. We need that as one of our MUX inputs to have a way of writing it. And with this picture, we're going to do that on DestD because the new value of the RSP is computed by adding or subtracting something. And that's going to be done by the ALU. And that's the only thing connected to the E input. And there's also some trickiness about whether we write RA or RB for some instructions. You can figure that out by carefully looking at the table and deciding whether I've connected the right one of RA and RB to DestD and DestM. I believe I already have, so that's kind of free. So we have inputs. So remember we had valM was our memory output, and value was our ALU output. In the textbook's design, they just hardwire valM to the input M to the register file, and they hardwire valE to the input E to the register file. They're just hardwired in the textbook's design. You do not have to do that. If you want to add a MUX over here or here, you can do that. That is fine. And that might make it easier to think about how to do things. But the textbook doesn't do that, so they're exactly the same. That might help reading the textbook's description of instructions. And we have DestM and DestD, which are our two register numbers. And we have our, apparently forgot to draw a set of, our MUX that controls that for DestD, for example. Or sometimes we want to write to RB, sometimes we want to write to nothing, and sometimes we want to write to RSP. So yesterday we noticed that the textbook did this thing where they add zero for some instructions. You don't have to do that, so you could, for example, have a MUX down here, but our textbook chose this option where they had the option of adding zero, and they used this for something like IRMOVEQ and RMOVEQ. But you can instead just have an extra MUX. That might make it easier to think about, because adding zero seems like a really non-intuitive thing to do for IRMOVEQ. So finally, we get to our last stage, which is updating the PC. So we choose the PC for the next cycle, and usually we choose valP, and we have three exceptions. We have call, jumps, and returns. So where does the PC come from for call? Where do we get the PC, next PC value? So we have like call, foo, and somewhere later we have foo, and this is the next instruction we run. Where do we get that address of foo in our processor? Yeah. In the instruction. Yeah, so it's in the instruction. So it's from the instruction memory. So for these, it's the part of instruction. And our textbook calls it valC, in which they determined when they split up the instruction in the fetch stage in their list of things to do. How about for return? Where do we get the next instruction to PC to location for return? So we have our foo here, then we have a return, and that return's going to go back to here. Where does return get that value from in our processor? Yeah?
Isn't it PC plus 9?
So it was, this address was PC plus 9 when call was running. So this is calls PC plus 9. But we're running return. So it's not PC plus 9 anymore, but it was. Yeah. From the stack, because what call did with PC plus 9 is save it to the stack. So we're going to get it. This is from the stack. And on our processor picture, where does the value from the stack show up? Yeah.
Is it from data memory?
From the data memory, which implies data memory. So we're going to set up the data memory to be reading the stack. So we're going to compute the address on the stack, where that is. We're going to pass it to the data memory, and out of the data memory is going to come the place we want to return to. And so that gives this design here, where sometimes we take val C, sometimes we take val P, and sometimes we take the val M, the memory output, and that's where what our PC gets set to, depending on the instruction. So, any questions about this overall picture? Yeah. About that? About what's happening before the PC? Yeah. Why is it PC plus 9 here? So this is PC plus 9. This is equal to val P for call. Or this is PC plus length of call. And the idea is when we have a call instruction, we want to find out what's after it. So it's the PC plus the length of the call instruction. And call is the only instruction where we actually store something. We actually do this. So we don't have to worry about other instruction lengths. Any other questions? OK. So given that, let's try this exercise. So I have my picture with a bunch of muxes. What do I do for return? How do I set up all these muxes for return? Or am I missing something I need to implement return? So someone wants to tell me one thing, yes.
Well, PC sensor needs to read from memory, data memory, and that would be the middle.
Yeah, so we need the middle one because we know we're going to get a value from data memory. We just discussed that we read a value from the stack. The place where we access the stack is by accessing the data memory. So that's going to be where our PC comes from. How about some other things? And you can try tracing backwards from that to figure out, well, what does the data memory input need to be? And that would be one way of going about this. So the data memory outputs a value from the stack. And what's the inputs? So any part of this that someone has a proposal for? Yeah?
For
DestDev
and SD,
you both take 0xf. So there's this observation that so you say both of them take 0xf. So you're saying we don't have to write any registers for return? OK. So anyone want to dispute that? Yeah.
We have to change the stack pointer.
We have to change the stack pointer. So you're half right that one of these better be 0xf, because we don't want to write two registers. But one of them will need to be the stack pointer. And on this picture, hopefully it's DestD or else we need a different box. And it will turn out that DestD will work on this picture. Okay, how about any other signals we can set? Yes. So you're saying, are we reading from the stack pointer? Yes. So we're going to read from, we're going to take memory at RSP is the return address. That's what we're going to assign to PC. So yes, and that gives us that mux next to the address input. We don't want the ALU value. Yes. LUA should be 8. We want to add or subtract 8. And in fact, we want to add 8. And nope, yeah. That was the one you had.
The bottom one, ALUB should be source B.
ALUB should be source B. We want to actually use the stack pointer. We don't want to add 0. We don't want to add 0 plus 8. It's not going to be very interesting. Okay, and we're only missing one mux, which is this source B mux, and we want to read from the stack pointer so we can add to the stack pointer. Okay, so any questions about this? And generally, if you're figuring this sort of thing out, like, you just work backwards. So one way of working is, I know the PC needs to get a value from the stack. I say, which of these, if any, can get a value from the stack? If the answer was none of them, I better add a input, or add a mux. And the answer is one of them, I choose that one, the data memory. And then I say, so the data memory better be reading a value from the stack. Where do I get that address? And I could just keep working backwards to figure out what inputs would work. That's a way you could figure this out. And if you discover there's nothing that would work, you always have the option of, in your processor, of adding a mux to make it happen. Like, just say, I can't get this input, I'm just going to add an input to the mux, even if it's different from the textbook, and that's fine. Yes?
Doing the data memory part, does it read or write?
So the question is, does it read or write? For a return, it better read. So this should be read. Not write. And we just didn't draw that on here with our habit of omitting control paths. Any other questions? Yeah?
We're not doing PC first time, right? So it should be reading from source A.
So the question is, this should be here, and the answer is it doesn't matter. Because we're not writing. So We don't care what we're inputting as the value because we better not be changing memory because it's not part of what return does. So other questions? Okay. So let's go on to our next topic, which is going to be about pipelining. So this is something I'm going to introduce with not an example of processors, but sort of a more mundane task. Let's talk about doing laundry. So I have some laundry to do. I have more than one load of laundry to do. So I take my white clothes and put them in the washer, let them get washed. When that's finished, I take them out of the washer, put them in the dryer. Wait a while, eventually that finishes, and then I take them out of the dryer, fold all of them, then I'm done, I put them away, and now I can move on to my next load, my colors, which I don't want to mix with the whites, we don't want to get everything messed up. So I take those, put them in the washer, wait for that to finish, take that out of the washer, put it in the dryer, wait for that to finish, then take them out of the dryer, fold them all up, put them away, and then I'm finally done with my laundry. Only took a couple hours, like a few hours. Okay, does this seem like I'm making good use of my time here? Anyone have any suggestions for how I could speed this up? Yeah.
Slide colors to left.
Okay, yeah, you want to start using the, you're saying, gosh, why aren't you using the washer here? Like, you have another load of laundry to do. Of course you should be using the washer right then, and all of you would do this. So, yeah, what we want to do is something where right after we're done with the washer, we don't just say, oh gosh, I haven't finished this load of laundry, I can't do the next one. You're going to say, the washer's free, I'm going to start using it. And we want to keep doing that, you know, as long as we have more laundry to do. Now I can get, you know, three loads of laundry done in less time than it took me to do two by just taking advantage of the fact that maybe I shouldn't just have my washer doing nothing when I still have loads of laundry, and I shouldn't have my dryer just sitting doing nothing when I still have loads of laundry to do, and so on. So this concept is our idea of a pipeline, that we do one step of one operation and then pass it on to the next step and then do the same step of that operation for the next thing. And we're going to do this not with loads of laundry, but with instructions in our processor eventually. But it's the same concept that, for example, we have our instruction memory, and in our current processor, like our washer here, we use our instruction memory to read the instruction, and then we're kind of done with it, but because we have to wait for the entire cycle to finish, we have all this time where the instruction memory isn't really doing anything. Well, it would be really nice to start reading the next instruction early. We're going to see how to make that possible and not have all this wasted time. So any questions about this concept so far? Yeah?
It's basically like a human assembly line.
So this is basically like an assembly line? Yeah. So our pipeline concept is an assembly line. We do one thing on everything, then we do and pass it on to the next step. Then we do that thing again on the next thing, pass it on to the next step, and so on. So our processor is going to work an assembly line, kind of like here. We're doing sort of more of an assembly line way of doing our laundry. Do all the, have everything do the washer step while things are also doing the dryer step, while things are also being folded. Because the washer and dryer are independent, just like we can, our instruction memory can work independently of, say, our register file. So let's talk about how much time this actually saves me. So one thing you say, well, this is a lot more efficient. But it's not, you know, perfect. In particular, I have a bunch of wasted time here. I have some time when, despite my best efforts, I'm not using my washer. My washer is just a little bit faster than my dryer, and that means that I can't really take advantage of my washer as much as would be totally optimal. In the perfect system, my washer would be busy all the time, but I can't do that. And you know, if you've done laundry, that probably it looks really more like this. My dryer is a lot slower than my washer. So I have all this time when the washer isn't being fully used, but at least it's a lot better than when I started out. And this means that my second load of laundry isn't actually getting done as fast as my first load of laundry. It isn't getting done as fast as when I was doing each load of laundry separately. When I did each load of laundry separately, back here, I didn't have any wasted time between when the washer finished and when the dryer started. It was right after each other. But now I do. Yeah. Here, I don't have any room for my first load. When I'm starting up, I don't have any time. But here, I had to wait. We can't move on to the next step until whoever's ahead of us in line has finished. So I have this wasted time. And there's going to be two important measures when we look at a system with pipelining, with this assembly line fashion, of how efficient things are. And one of them is going to be what we call latency. And latency is the time to finish one thing. So here, one load of laundry. How long does that take from when I start it to when I actually finish it? For our processor, we'll talk about how long does it take from when I start running an instruction to when I finish running that instruction and I've stored all of its results and it's all done. And here, my latency is 2.1 hours. I start that load at about 11:30 and I finish it 2.1 hours later, including the wasted time where I was just having the clothes sit because the washer was done, but the dryer wasn't ready yet. And that means that this was less efficient than if, as far as like how long each load took, than when I started out. When I started out, I didn't have that time. I just moved it right from the washer to the dryer. So each load of laundry, if you asked me how long did it take you to do each load, was faster. It took a little less than 2 hours. But we're fine with that, because overall, it's obviously I'm getting a lot more work done. And when I'm doing my laundry, usually what I care about is not how long did it take me from when I started the load to when I finished. I care about how long did it take me to do all the work. And the same thing is going to be true with our processor. If you have a function with 50 instructions to run, what you care about is how long did those 50 instructions take to run, not how long did it take to run the first push instruction. Like, you don't particularly care how long that took individually, you care about the whole package. And that's why this is still going to be beneficial, even though in our processor we're going to have this sort of waste. That we're not going to make things perfect, we're going to be wasting time waiting for and someone else to catch up to us and be ready to move on to the next step. And what we really care about is something known as throughput. So throughput is the rate at which things finish or start, the rate of getting many things done. So one way we can measure it is, what's the time once we've started going? Let's say I have a lot of loads of laundry. So here I just have tons of loads, and when I'm doing tons of loads of laundry, how often do I finish a load? And that is a measure of throughput. And here, that's going to be a little less than every hour with the times I have here. When I finish. And typically, when we measure throughput, we're going to measure it in units of work done per unit time. So we'll say I'm getting 1.2 loads of laundry done per hour. And that's typically for laundry what we care about. It's not, am I getting each load done as fast as possible? It's how many am I doing when I'm doing them in bulk. And the same is going to be true for instructions. So something to note is that the time between when things finish, when we have this full pipeline, where we're always starting a new piece of work every time one finishes, is the same as the time between when things start. So we can measure either place, we'll get the same number. In fact, we can measure in the middle. We can measure the time when things start using the dryer to when, or the time between the time, yeah, so like here, time between when one load starts using the dryer to the next, or the time between when one load finishes using the washer to the next, and we'll always get the same answer. The rate is the same when the system is full. When we have lots of loads, no matter where you measure, we get the same throughput. We have, in this case, 1.2 loads per hour at every stage. That's our steady state. You know, it doesn't quite look like that when we're just starting out, but once things get going, that's where things are going to be. So this idea makes sense. So throughput is we're getting many things done. How fast do we get work done overall? Latency is for each individual thing we're doing, like each load of laundry, how long did it take from start to finish? And laundry and our processor are examples where typically what we really care about is throughput and not latency. But there might be other applications where you care about latency. Like, if you were doing laundry and your goal was, I need to get this washed as soon as possible, you don't want to have a whole bunch of other things that you might have to wait for being done. You want to just have a dedicated washer, dryer, and table for that, just one thing, and stop everything else, because that's the fastest way of doing it. You know, because then, in that case, you cared about latency. You cared about how long it took to get this particular one thing done from start to finish. But we're going to care about throughput, and that's why we're going to do pipelining. Because it's going to make our throughput a lot better than if we did things one at a time. Because when we started out, you know, we were getting, our throughput would have been, it would take us 1.8 hours for each one, so it would have been less than one load per hour if we just did things one at a time. Even though the time from start to finish of each one would be a little better. So this is the pipelining idea for our laundry example. Now let's move to applying it to circuits. But before I do that, any questions? So I'm going to apply this to a circuit. I'm going to use a toy circuit here that you observing people might notice that there's an obviously more efficient way of doing. Here I'm multiplying A times 3, and I'm doing it with two adders. And let's think about the timeline for this. So the way our adder is going to work is we put an input on the adder, and after some amount of time, the output will stabilize to our result consistently. And I'm going to say for this adder, let's say that takes 50 picoseconds. So let's say I want to multiply 7 times 3. So I put in 7. I have this adder now has 7 on its two inputs, and it starts working, and after 50 picoseconds, its output stabilizes. All the gates manage to have their values be stable from when they were changing before, when the input was not stable yet. And after 50 picoseconds, this wire has 14 on it, and it's not changing anymore from calculations being done. And when that happens, now the second adder has the value 14 and the value 7 on its inputs. And the second adder can finally get to work computing 14 plus 7. It does that addition, and it gets 21 at its output after another 50 picoseconds. So any questions about this timeline here? So this is the circuit we're starting with. Timeline makes sense. So here I have 100 picoseconds latency. And because I'm doing one thing at a time, this means I have 10 results per nanosecond. And that's what I can get with this circuit. So if I wanted to do this repeatedly, I put in 7, I get out 50 picoseconds later, I compute 14, and then I finally get 21, and we're kind of glossing over. Somehow I'm going to have to put that value somewhere. We'll assume we can just do that somehow. We'll talk about how we do that later. Then I can put in 17, compute another number, and do this every 100 picoseconds. And I can use this to multiply a whole series of numbers by 3. So in this case, we basically have a simple processor. The instructions in our processor are just numbers to multiply times 3. Very boring, but useful for illustrating this. And like with our laundry example, our second adder here, we don't use it originally. Then we use it for the second half of this 50 picoseconds. Then we don't use it. And the observation you make is, well, we'd really like to use it all the time, just like we use the dryer all the time. And we really like to use this first adder all the time, not just for the first half of each 100 picoseconds, just like we use the washer all the time. That it's a shame that we use this to compute the value 14, and then for the rest of the time we're computing 7 times 3, we can't use it anymore. It's just sitting there doing nothing. We're wasting hardware, doing useless work. So the timeline we like is something more like this. That instead, we input 7, we get out, we compute 14, and we send that on to the second adder, and meanwhile, we input 17 and start using the first adder to compute 17 plus 17, while the second adder is computing 14 plus 7. And we get out the same string of numbers that we would have gotten out from here, but we do it in less time. And because people usually don't understand this timeline by looking at it, I'm going to walk through an example of how we do this. And an observation here is I've added registers. Why did I need to add registers? So why did I add these registers to do this? Yeah. Yeah, so the issue is we can't change this wire while and read from write and read from the wire at the same time. And one way of thinking about it is that during this point in time, the first adder is outputting 14. Like the first adder's job is to store the value 14 for us. And we're actually are using it. We're not using it to do computation, but we're using it to store 14. So the second adder can do its work. And if we want to have the first adder instead compute something else, we need to somehow hold that value in a register. That's a tool for holding values. So the first adder can do other work other than outputting 14. For us to use. So we need some place to store that value while we're computing the new value so we don't have to worry about it changing while we're trying to use it. So here I have registers, and the labeling of these registers is perhaps a bit non-intuitive. So the idea is T represents our time step, so at time 0 equals T equals 0, we'd say that this register will hold the output from t equals 0. This register will hold the intermediate values for t equals 1 for the next input. And this register will hold the following input. And that's what the naming is from. So the t plus 0 plus 1 plus 2 indicates when do we input these numbers into the system. And values flow in this in the left to right direction. So at time t equals 2, we have a value, an A, and it will move to, and the next time step, it will be in the middle set of registers for 2 times A and next step. So let's walk through what's in these registers. So we input 7. So we set this first register here to 7. And then we add 7 plus 7, and we get 14. So 14 is input to this register. And this is what happens during this first time unit. So then we have a rising edge of the clock. I suppose I should probably draw the clock. We have a rising edge of the clock, happens here. And we do some writes. So we have a new input, 17, to here. This 14 gets copied over to here. And we had 7, which was the previous value from our A T plus 2 register, which gets, just like the add result, copied over to the other side. So then we have our, after this rising edge, we have 17, the next value we're multiplying times 3. And we have the intermediate values for the first value we wanted to multiply. We have 14, 2 times A, 2 times that first value. And 7, a copy of that first value, because we can't use the original register, now that's holding 17. So we have to have another copy of it for the next step of the computation. And 7 plus 14 will be computed, and we'll get 21 here. And during the next time step, we'll take this 21, we'll copy it over as the output of this, and we'll have 17 plus 17, we'll be computing 34 here, which gets copied over there, and we'll have 17, which ends up getting copied over to there. At the next rising edge of the clock after that. So questions about this timeline? Why we have these registers here? So notice that the pattern, and this is a general pattern that we'll see in doing this, is that we basically just said, we have two parts of the circuit, I'm going to draw a line, and everything that crosses that line, I'm going to put a register there. And that's because I want them to be independent, so I need to store the values while the other side is working. So the left side can do some work while the right side has the same values. I'm going to store the values for the right side in these registers to separate the two parts. And that's why we just decided, we just drew a line, everything that crossed the line, we put a register so the right side could work independently. So this is our basic setup for pipelining. That we add these registers, and that lets us have each of the stages act independently. They have their own set of registers storing that stage's inputs. So we have our left stage here, has the blue register, the blue AT plus 2 register storing its input. The second stage has the pair of registers in the middle storing its inputs, and that's always true at every step, and the values just flow from, in this case, left to right as they move from stage to stage. And you have two parts of the computation going on at once, one for each act. So one thing that, if you were looking carefully, you may have noticed about this picture is that this time here, the time for us to do two stages, I wrote as more than 100 picoseconds. Even though each adder took exactly 50 picoseconds, you might say, well, that means we can put a new value in every 50 picoseconds. And in this picture, I'm spending more time. And the reason I'm doing that is trying to be more realistic because of how things are going to work, because we had to have registers. We needed registers to store values while we were computing it. Otherwise, you know, this adder here wouldn't know what to add. And registers have this issue. So if you remember, our register, it takes an input, it has an output, and at the rising edge of the clock, it copies the input to the output. And what we've shown you so far, the idea is the rising edge of the clock is this one instant in time, and at that time, it reads its input, copies it to its output, just immediately, instantaneously. But registers, unfortunately, are physical things, and like physical things, they can't actually do anything instantaneously. So there's some tolerances registers have. In particular, before the rising edge of the clock, there's some amount of time during which the register's input can't change. If it changes, the register won't read the right value. Like, it won't actually be sure what the value is, and it will produce a bad result. We obviously never want that to happen in our circuits. We never want the PC to sometimes have the wrong value because we were not changing it. We were changing it too close to the rising edge of the clock. And after the rising edge of the clock, it might take some time for its output to stabilize because, you know, some bits have to change from 0 to 1. That can't happen instantaneously, physically. So there's some amount of time for that output to change and actually stabilize to the new value. And this means that when you add a register to the circuit, you add a little bit of extra time you need for that circuit to act. Now you need a little time before the rising edge of the clock in order to make sure the input is stable just before there, that the adder is not still computing, that it's done, it has one value on the wire, that value is not changing so the register can work. And afterwards, we need a little extra time to wait for the adder to have a stable input from the previous registers. And we'll call the total of these two times the register delay. In this class, we're not going to be concerned about what part of the register delay is from the input needing to not change and what part's from the output changing. We're just going to call the whole quantity the register delay. And we're going to deal with that. But these register delays mean that when we add pipelining, because we need to store values between the stages, because things like adders need to have one input value that's the same for their entire computation, that means we're going to make the circuit a little slower because of this register delay. Because we're going to have to wait this extra amount of time for each value to flow through. So questions about these register tolerances? Yeah?
So register delay, is it very small compared to adder delay?
So the question, is the register delay very small compared to the adder delay? I believe this is generally the case, though it might depend on the type of adder or the width of the adder doing. I'm afraid I'm not super familiar with the actual current physical values for these things in current generation transistors. Okay, so we have some register delay. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to figure out, well, okay, given that, how fast is this actually? And the idea is that, well, we know our adder takes 50 picoseconds, and we have these registers. Each of them takes 10 picoseconds because that's the register delay, that we need to wait 10 picoseconds to use them. That's the combination of the time before and after the rising edge of the clock. And given this, we want to compute our throughput and our latency. So what's our latency? So what we're saying is that we have to first put in a value here. We have to wait 10 picoseconds for that value to go through this register to be stored and read out again. Then you have to wait 50 picoseconds for it to be added one the first time. Then we have to wait 10 picoseconds to be stored in these registers, 50 and 10. And so we'll say that our latency is about 130 picoseconds with how this picture looks. From end to end, it takes 130 picoseconds for a value to go into one register and out the last register. For our throughput, we're going to be concerned about how long does it take a value to go one stage. Remember that throughput was time between finishes and time between starts. So I'm just going to measure the time between when we finish one stage. And every 60 picoseconds, we can finish once the first stage. And the same is true of the second stage. So we don't have to worry about waiting in line. So every 60 picoseconds, we can start a new thing to multiply times 3. And that means we have a throughput of one thing that is done every 60 picoseconds, which is about 16 billion operations per second. Which is a little slower than our ideal, which would be 1 over 50 or 20 billion operations per second. So any questions about how I computed that? Okay. So I just looked at the time to go through one stage, and that told me how much I could get done, as far as how often I would finish new multiplies times threes, or how often I would start new multiplies times threes, which told me my throughput. So we started with, if you may remember, we started with things taking 100 picoseconds. So we started with 10 billion ops a second. And we got up to 16. Can we do better? And you might say, OK, well, if dividing it in two pieces made it faster, maybe we can divide it into more than two pieces. So let's divide it up into four pieces. Let's just drop some registers in the middle of the computation. You know, get part, you know, presumably a router's doing something. We could just drop a register in the middle there and get some results. And, you know, and if this works out, like maybe we have 10 picoseconds for a register, 25 picoseconds for the first part of the 10 picoseconds for that register there, and so on. Okay. So let's start with a first question, which is, after I've done this, what should the throughput of this be? If somehow I managed to do this, just drop register, split it up in half again, split each half stage up in half again, what's my throughput now? Yeah. Yeah, so now the time for each stage is 35 picoseconds, and it doesn't matter which one we measure. It doesn't matter whether we measure the register before or after. We get 35 picoseconds for every stage. So it's 1 over 35, which is about 28 billion operations per second. Okay. So great, we can just keep making things faster. So there are two issues you might have with this. So one issue is, well, is this really unlimited? Can we actually get arbitrarily fast? Another issue you might have is, how did you put a register in the middle of an adder? Is that possible? Seems unlikely. We'll address both of these issues. We'll address the first issue, and we'll work on the second issue. The answer is no. We'll do that after the exam. So the first issue, well, as we divide up the logic more and more, even if we can divide it perfectly, we can split it up arbitrarily, which turns out we can't, we still have this register delay. And that register delay becomes a bigger and bigger part of each stage. So eventually, we're doing 1 picosecond of computation, hypothetically, somehow, and then doing 10 picoseconds to move values in and out of registers. So if you chart our, you know, latency time per stage, we have an asymptotic chart that we can never get below our register delay in the time per stage. We can get arbitrarily close, assuming we can keep splitting up the logic. We never get there. And we have a very big speed up when we start, and it gets smaller and smaller the more that register delay matters. And we can also chart this with throughput. And the same thing is that we have the maximum rate at which we can update registers, and we can get arbitrarily close to that, assuming we can keep splitting up the logic, but we never quite make it, and we have these diminishing returns as we do that. Okay, so I think that's where I'll finish. After the exam, we'll go back to, well, we can't do this, so what happens? Also, since there's an exam next week, next Tuesday is exam review. If you want us to talk about things, you should have questions, because if you don't ask us, we assume you know it.